What you are about to hear is a series of planned programs or meetings for interested members of Alcoholics Anonymous held at what we believe to be the first all-AA retreat ever conducted in Southern California. It is our hope that this retreat can be repeated again in the coming months. You are, and Harold C. of Whittier were instrumental in bringing this idea to fruition. Your commentator in these remarks is Wally S. The retreat started late Friday afternoon, March 29, and ended Sunday noon, the 31st. Those in attendance came from an area encompassed by the two points of Long Beach and Pasadena. The retreat master for all the sessions was Chuck C. of Laguna Beach. Before we rolled the tape of the Saturday morning session, which was the first session taped, I would like to comment briefly on the purpose of the retreat and the facilities available to us. The retreat was planned for AA men desirous of improving spiritual awareness attained through greater knowledge and practice of the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. The retreat provided the much-needed opportunity for AAs to fulfill their inner desires of greater spiritual awareness and at the same time retire from worldly cares to enjoy the quiet solitude of a hilltop retreat. Recreational facilities were made available to retreatants. Meals and lodging was provided at nominal cost. Periods of silence were maintained, and individual counseling was made available at specified times. A regular AA participation meeting was held Friday night in the spacious lodge before a big roaring fireplace to enable participants to get acquainted or to otherwise unwind. Two meetings were held Saturday morning, two in the afternoon and a question and answer session Saturday night. The Sunday morning meeting ended at noon, at which time we were served a delicious home-cooked dinner in the rustic dining room. We chose the facilities of the Edendale Christian Retreat because of its beautiful location in the quiet green hills of Carbon Canyon near Placentia, California. We slept in a heated dormitory which can accommodate 64 people. All of our meals were prepared by our hosts and served in the rustic dining room. Our meetings were held indoors in the lodge and out in the open under a large brush arbor. In the outdoor tapes, you will hear the constant singing of birds, the shrill call of the peacocks, the guinea hens, the crowing of a rooster, and even the braying of a friendly jackass. It seems everyone and everything was bidding us welcome.
That'll do it. Well, gentlemen, we won't let them talk because that cuts down on my time. I got to tell you again that I do not fancy myself as an authority. I'm not an oracle. And again, what I have to say will be as I read it. We might at times talk a little bit about certain scriptural passages, but I don't like to have to depend on passages to prove a point, particularly. You know, if you're in a discussion and it's a matter of quotations, whoever knows the most verses wins the argument. And so, in the main, we are going to be spending our time on the lessons of life, and we might then fit them into certain spiritual concepts that might prove a point or bolster it up. When I was about 12 or 13, we had a revival meeting in the church that I belonged to, or that I grew up in. And I went down to get religion. I went down to get saved. And I hadn't sinned yet. But I went down to get saved. And nothing happened to me. Nothing happened. And preacher came down to help me. And he'd say, "How you doing?" And I'd say, "Not good. Not good." And finally, we both were out. And he says, "Well, when you get baptized, it'll happen." And so when the ice went out, I went in. And nothing happened. And he says, "Well, when you get formally taken into the church, it'll happen." And so this took place, and nothing happened. And I was very disappointed because I wanted something to happen. And I immediately set out to try to find out why it didn't happen. What was the matter? And this started a 30-year search. I started first on the Bible, and then I did a lot of reading in it. And then when I was 16, I had a little experience that I want to bring out for a reason. I was born right away on the railroad, working on an extra gang between school terms. And we came to a cut, and I went up on one side, and somebody else went up on the other, and the rest of the gang went through. And I was mowing, swinging a scythe. It was hotter than the hinges. And there was no process of thought, really. All I had to do was just swing that scythe. And I moved into a great field of these big yellow daisies, black-eyed Susans, I think they call them. They came right out to the edge of this cut, and then the whole field, even outside the right-of-way, was covered with these daisies. And the verse popped into my head, "Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin, and yet I say unto you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these." And without process of thought again, the question, what does it mean? And the answer immediately means this, what it says. If an individual can abandon himself to life, even as the lily, as the daisy, he will find that underneath are the everlasting arms. And something happened to me that morning that I never spoke about for many years because it scared me pretty bad. I had a little period of what might be likened to Bill's experience in the bedroom when he says, "Oh God, if there be a God, reveal yourself to me now." I stood there maybe for 1 minute, maybe for 10 minutes, I don't know. Without weight, without substance, without anything but the knowledge of the unity of life. The oneness of life. It was a period without being there really to enjoy it. There was no feeling but ecstasy. And I woke up and that was it. It wasn't something that I would attempt to call back because there was no there's no one there to enjoy it. It was just a feeling of ecstasy. And so that was a thing that stayed with me for the years, because from that moment until now, I have known of the unity of life. I went ahead searching, and I went through pretty well all the major religions, and much of the philosophical and religious writings. Several Bibles. And nothing happened. I became proficient in intellectual knowledge. And this is one of the first points that I want to bring out in this little thing. One of the great paradoxes of life is that we can know intellectually and believe and still live in hell. This is a strange thing. That intellectual knowledge will not do it for us. We have been conditioned to put so much faith in and stress on intellectual knowledge. But intellectual knowledge that is not put to use through action actually is a millstone. It's very damaging to know better than you do. And so I have known intellectually ever since I was born that there was a God. I can't go back far enough in memory where I can find a time that I did not believe in God. Neither did I ever get drunk enough not to believe in God. But I still had to spend 10 of the worst years that one can imagine in hell. Now, during this time, I wasn't very much interested in people. Early in my life, I soured on people. My personal experience with people wasn't good. They hurt me. And I sort of wrote off the human race early in life. And for most of this period of 30 years when I was searching, my interest was not in people. My interest was in God. I must be able to understand and define and pinpoint the Almighty. At the ripe old age of 43, I had used up all of my own resources. I mean all of them. All the people I had not chipped off. The few that I wanted to keep chipped me off. And I was left without people, without health, without sanity, without money, without a job, without a home. Totally and completely bereft of all of my own resources. In 1941, in August and March 41, I had read Jack Alexander's article in Saturday Evening Post. So from 41 to January 46, I knew of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I could not come to Alcoholics Anonymous. As long as I had choice, I could not come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I didn't like the good people in the human race, and the drunks I hated. I hated them because I was a drunk, and I hated me, and I hated all of you. And the very idea of me coming to a bunch of drunks for help was absolutely unthinkable. I could not come. I wouldn't even discuss it. My wife once in a while would ask me why I didn't investigate Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't even discuss it with her. This was unthinkable to me. And so I had to burn completely up. And this happened. Started in the Friday before Christmas, 1945. I had a little good fortune. The boss gave me a little Christmas present instead of shooting me. And if there's one thing that's worse for an alcoholic than bad fortune, it's good fortune. So I got drunk on the way home. I had been sober for about 3 months, from October to December. But I couldn't take this, and I got drunk on the way home. And what I mean is, I got drunk. Now, I didn't do this. The last 10 years of my life, I didn't get drunk in one evening. I had recognized that I had a problem with this stuff, this flit. And I was very careful. I sampled my way in. And usually it took weeks before I'd get off my feet. Because I was careful. I wasn't going to do it this time, you see. But on this particular occasion, I got drunk. And I lost Christmas and the time between Christmas and New Year's and New Year's. And probably the first 2 weeks of January. I do not know within 10 days of when I came to this society. But during this time, I did nothing but empty bottles. I just poured down whiskey. Most of the time was spent in bed. Every time I'd open my eyes, I'd drink. And I didn't eat. And so I had nothing in my body but whiskey. And yet I woke up about the middle of January with a period of sanity, with a head as clear as it has ever been in my lifetime. And for the first time in my entire life, I saw me without anything between me and me. There wasn't an excuse left on earth. And I saw me with nothing between me and me. And I knew without knowing why that I'd lost the battle of life. And I knew that I couldn't get out of it alone. I knew why my wife, after 20 years, was divorcing me. And this time, it was for real. And I knew she should have divorced me 10 years beforehand. And I knew why my kids wouldn't come home when I was around if they could help it. And I knew why the boss, who had very graciously given me a nice Christmas present and a little to talking to, I knew why he'd send word to the house that if I ever step foot in the plant again, he's going to throw me through the window. And the window to which he referred, many of you have seen, and it don't open. It's plate glass. And I completely and totally accepted the fact that morning that everything dear to me in life was gone, and I was not entitled to have it back. Now, I'd like to say that over again, because I want you to hear it. Remember it. Because it is on this experience, and many that I have seen like it, that I base my entire concept of life, our relationship, yours and mine, to each other, and our relationship to God. I accepted the fact that everything dear to me in life was gone, and that I was not entitled to have it back. Now, my life was over. I knew I was going to die because I'd come awful close to it the time before. The oxygen squad had had to wake me up the last time out. And this was all right with me. It was perfectly okay. But I must be sober to die. And for one reason, and one reason only. I didn't want sobriety for myself, because my life was over. But I must be sober till I died in order to rub out as much of the record as I could rub out before I kicked off. This was my only reason for sobriety. I didn't want to die with those boys and their mother and the people that were closest to me, remembering me only as a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunk. Now, this was the only reason that I wanted to be sober, Linda, that I might rub out the rest. And the last thing that went through my mind before the curtain came down and I was again insane, drunk, and deathly sick, I remembered that I'd read Jack Alexander's article in 1941. And I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find AA. Now, this was the last thing that happened. And then, boom, down came the curtain. Now, from that moment until this, I've never had to take another drink of liquor, a sedating or tranquilizing pill of any kind, from that moment to this. It probably took me at least a week, maybe 10 days, to get well enough even to look for AA. And when I was well enough to look, I hadn't sense enough to look in the phone book. It was an anonymous thing, you know. It never occurred to me that there'd be any information in the phone book or any place else about it. And the only source of information I had was people. And so we called people and asked them if they knew anybody that knew anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I finally got a telephone number, and it was the number of Kent Taylor. We lived in Beverly Hills at the time. And some doctor gave us Kent Taylor's number. And I called Kent, and he was making a picture, and he's working nice. And he said to me, "Have you had a drink today?" And I said, "No. I'm in no danger of taking a drink today because I'm a periodic." But he said, "Don't take one, and maybe tomorrow I can take you to a meeting." And I called him for 3 or 4 days. They're still working. And I said to him, "Kent, you don't need to take me to a meeting. Where is a meeting that I can go to?" And he told me of the meeting of the West End Group, it was called. And it met on Sunday night at the corner of Wilshire and Santa Monica in Beverly Hills, in the Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall. And so it was Sunday. And I went to that meeting. Now, I hadn't any idea of what I was going to find. I knew nothing, only my hazy memory of the article, and I probably was 4 sheets to the wind when I read it. And so I put on the only 2 good garments I had left, which was a camel's hair coat and a hat. This camel's hair coat had a big collar on, and I belt in the middle, you know. And I tied myself up and pulled that collar up over my head and pulled my hat down over my face and sallied forth. And I got the meeting before it opened, before it started. And there were probably 35 or 40 people there. And they were all talking. Every one of them. Yacking their heads off. Nobody listening. Just like they always do, you know. And I looked in through the door. And they didn't look like me. And they weren't dressed like me. And they didn't feel like me. And they most certainly weren't talking like me. And I stood there and listened and looked, and I said to myself, he got his information balled up. This is the wrong night. These are the veterans and their wives, and they're here for a party. And I'll have to leave and come back the night the drunks are here. And I'm telling you something, I was dying. Here I'd come, finally, to an AA meeting, and there wasn't one. And there was going to have to be some more loss of time. And it was the most disappointing experience that you can imagine. And I turned to leave. And some monkey who had been watching me, I reckon, hurried over. And he said to me, "Mister, were you looking for somebody?" And I said, "No, sir." And he says, "Well, what were you looking for?" And thinking it was a veteran, I said to him, "Well, sir, if it would interest you, I was looking for sobriety." And the guy lit up like a church. And I was hooked before he ever opened his mouth. You gentlemen all know the aloneness of an alcoholic who's run out of time. Who hasn't even his own family to talk to. Who has nobody to talk to. And a stranger comes up and lights up like a Christmas tree. Because he's glad you're there. This is the most terrific thing. I'll never hear words like his next words. Why, he says, take off your hat and coat. You're in the right place. And they took me on their laps and rocked me to sleep. Strangers to me. Now I decided I wanted what they had and became willing to go to any length to get it that night. And yet, I attended meetings every night of the week for 6 months with a great fear upon me that I couldn't have what they had. I didn't think I had enough left, either physically or mentally, to get it. But I was in a meeting every night because I wanted more than life. And after 6 months of a meeting every night, I woke up to the fact that I was sober and had been from the very beginning. And it was the first great awakening in my life. Now that was 16 and a half years ago. And my life for 16 and a half years has been nothing but awakenings and discarding. That's all it's been. Awakenings and discarding. Awakening to the fact that this has happened, and this has happened, and this has happened in my living experience, and then discarding the things that don't fit with the living experience. And I suspect that will be my life forever. Now, let us look at the miracle of AA itself. What happened? If there had been anything for me to do, if there had been a river to cross, I could not have crossed it. If there had been anything for me to do but toss in the towel, in complete and total surrender, I could not have done it. Doctors and priests and preachers have told me that this little bedroom experience of mine is not uncommon to those who are dying. They say that it's quite common for a person who is in the very act of dying to have a little period of sanity. And to be able to see himself as he is. I know nothing of this, only what they tell me. And they say if we make the right decision, we come back. And if we make the wrong decision, we go ahead and die. You don't bother me at all if you don't bother you. I only know what happened to me. I tossed in the towel for the first time in my life at 43. I knew within myself that I had lost the fight. And something happened. And this is what we're going to look at. Something happened, and I haven't had to drink anymore. Now, you all know that next, particularly the next 10 days, that every nerve cell in my body was yelling for liquor. Every one of them yelling, screaming for liquor. But everything in me was, how long can I live without a drink? And long before anybody ever told me, I'd put my basis on the 15 minutes of my life on the basis of a 15-minute deal. I'd just live as long as I could without a drink and then start over and do it again. And something happened. Somehow or another, I didn't have to take that next drink. Now with 17 years, a couple of months, without the necessity to take a drink, and looking back at this thing, we have to make certain conclusions. Number one, the miracle of AA itself, with no other supporting evidence, proves the power. Proves the power. There is a power greater than myself that is personal to me under certain conditions. The very miracle itself proves the power. I cannot live and drink, and of myself, I cannot keep from drinking. And yet, from the moment of surrender until now, I haven't had to take a drink. This proves the power. And it proves it can be related to the individual. Now, it also proves to me the eternality of life. You might say, well, how in the world would it prove the eternality of life? There is no stretch of my imagination that can conceive of a reason for me to be returned from the land of the living dead into the land of the living. 17 years ago, to die tonight. If death were, then was my time to die. I was already 9/10 dead. And yet I was returned from the land of the living dead into the land of the living. And I cannot conceive in any way why any power would have returned me to life to die tonight. So to me, it absolutely proves both the power and the eternality of life. Now, there's another thing that it proves to me. That there is nothing in this personal experience that would indicate that we have to earn the kingdom. You know, I was taught as a kid that you had to earn the stars in your crown. You got to earn them. You either earn a position in heaven or you go to hell. Well, again, if there had been any earning to do, it couldn't have started as it did. You see, I'd have had to get even first. I'd have had 25 years to go to get back even because I had a 25-year drinking career when I went backwards. And so, if there had been any earning to do, I couldn't have done that. So the thing must be free under certain conditions. It must be free. So, in my own thinking, this proves to me that the gift of God was made its foundations the earth. It's not made now. It was made its foundations the earth. And it's mine for free, but not on my terms. Not on my terms at all. On his terms. And what are his terms? That we as individuals come to see that life as we are living it, as we are calling the shots, is not worth the candle. That I, on my own power, am not worth the powder to blow me to hell. Apart from this thing, I am a tongue chewing, babbling idiot drunk writhing in the floor. Not worth the powder to blow me to hell. Apart from, but a part of, I am complete, I am fulfilled. Now, let's look at the thing just a minute. Here's the first verse. I like very much the New Testament account of creation. In the New Testament, it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And without the Word was not anything made that was made. And the Word and God became flesh and dwelt amongst us. And God became people. Let's look at it again. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And without the Word was not anything made that was made. And the Word became flesh, and God became flesh and dwelt amongst us. Now what that says to me, and what my miraculous experience in AA proves to me, is the unity of life. Just as I had it demonstrated to me on the hill back there, on the cut, when I was 16 years old. The unity of life. The good book says, God is life. You and I are alive. Unity. One life with many faces. One life with many faces. In him we live and move and have our being. Being. Not two lives. Not a life for me and one for Doc and one for Harold and one for you. And another little bitty one for Jack White. One life with many faces. God is life, and you and I have our identity in it. One mind common to all men. One mind common to all men. One life common to all men. One life of many faces. And God is that life. Therefore, God is that which I am, infinitely greater than I, because God is all life. Infinitely greater than I. But immediately available in all of its wonder, according to my own position in it. This is the most marvelous concept under heaven. Now, I said, not on my terms, on his. And what are his terms? That I become a part of this thing consciously, a conscious awareness that I live in the one life. That in him I live and move and have my being. Now, what is it that makes it appear that we are all separate? That we are all different? And that we have a life of our own and a mind of our own. What is it that allows us to live in conscious separation? I have come to believe that there's only one problem in life. Just one. One problem that includes all problems. And it's so simple. It is just this thing, the feeling of conscious separation from life, good, God, which are synonymous terms in my book. And this is all there is. This is all there is. Life, good, God. The feeling of conscious separation from, which puts me out here in left field. Here's the deal, here. Here's the fence, the roadblock. The feeling of conscious separation from, and here am I in the far country. Alone, walking alone. I walked alone for 43 years. Now I believe that this feeling of conscious separation from is the best definition of the human ego you and I will ever hear. I think this is the thing. And I think it forms the only curtain between man and man and man and God. The only roadblock there is. The feeling of conscious separation from, which is the human ego, which says that I am the boss man. I am the power. I'll do it my way. I can run my life. Leave me alone. I know what I'm doing. Now that's the problem, and it includes all problems. All fear, all frustration, all dis-ease, all disease, and all insecurities caused by this one thing. Now that thing's got to go by the boards. The feeling of conscious separation from. It's got to go by the boards. And how does it go by the boards? Surrender. Surrender. The abandonment of self. they're awakening to the fact that life as we live in it is not satisfactory. There must be a better something than this. Or, as it happened in my case, the end result of the bottle itself, the bottle finally beat me to death into total nothingness, with nothing left to defend, nothing left to be proud of, nothing to fight with or for. And the abandonment of self, and this thing in surrender goes to the board. And then one wakes up in here. Now you see, I said the feeling of conscious separation from. Because there is no life apart from. There's only life apart of. There is experience apart from, but no life apart from. Again, if there had been a river in here for me to cross, I couldn't have crossed it. I could not have gotten back. But when this thing went to the boards, I was back already. I didn't know it. I had to awaken to the fact. Out of my own living experience. My wife knew it. My kids knew it. The boss knew it. I didn't know it. But they were aware that something had happened to me long before I was. And so it is that this is the great good fortune of the alcoholic. Because if he comes to the program not surrendered, and if he decides he wants what's here and becomes willing to go to any length to get it, and then does the first 9 steps of our program, they'll surrender it. If he does them as honestly as he knows how to the best of his ability. At number 10, we are surrendered if we have done these things as honestly as we know how, to the best of our ability. And so this thing, this conscious separation, is temporarily gone. And we are in the center of the deal itself. That's why I've talked of nothing but surrender for 17 years. This is the only curtain between us and each other and God. Now, the thing then changes from the feeling of conscious separation from into the feeling of conscious unity with, living in, a part of. Now let's relate this to the thing that allows you and me, as alcoholics, to decide we want sobriety more than life. Let's go right back to the guy. When he walks up to me and he says, "Mister, were you looking for somebody?" And I said, "No, sir." And he says, "What were you looking for?" And I said, "I was looking for sobriety. If it would interest you, I was looking for sobriety." And he lights up like a Christmas tree. What is this? What was it that allowed this man to light up when all of those who knew me turned the light out and told me to be gone? They wanted no part of me. How come this man could light up? Because, you see, he knew both my problem and my answer. Because he had had the same problem, and he had found his answer. And in the very finding of it, he had to share it in love. A great love. The love of one alcoholic for another. Now, what is this? This, in my book, is the spirit of Almighty God. This is the thing that allows us to get sober. And the practice of the principles allows us to remain sober. We don't get sober by the principles. We get sober by the spirit and maintain sobriety by the principles, practice the principles, getting rid of the rubbish, getting free. Now, it's this simple. And let's look then again at what the learned have said about this. I like very much what a Dominican priest said about it back in Germany in the 11th or 12th century. This guy was talking about surrender. And he said, "You have heard that nature abhors a vacuum. I tell you that God abhors a vacuum and can't abide a vacuum any place under heaven, however small." Now, says he, all you got to do is move out. Get empty of self. And automatically, you're full of God. Now, this pretty well dovetails with the little experience I was telling you about there in bed. And then another guy, and he happened to be Catholic also, Brother Lawrence. He lived in 1066. And in counseling a friend, he said to him this, "If you would find God, look deep within yourself. Because it's the only place you're ever going to find him." Now, in this conscious separation state, out here in the far country, I looked in all the religions, all the great systems. I studied the Bibles of many. But I was always looking yonder. Always looking yonder. I had it located outside myself someplace. And I was trying to find somebody else's God. Somebody else's God. The God of the Catholic. The God of the New Thought Movement, the God of Methodism, and Hard Shell Baptist, and Brahmanism, if you will, and Buddhism, and Taoism, and a lot of always looking yonder, and I couldn't find, and I quit looking. Came back home, saw myself as I was, tossed in the towel, and uncovered the thing I was looking for. Uncovered it. By the doing of these simple things. Now, this is the simplicity of this deal. The change that took place, and I didn't even know it had taken place. This is another discovery. After walking with you people for many months, I woke up to the fact that I was no longer interested in pinpointing and defining and understanding the Almighty. I was no longer interested in that. But I was interested in God's kids. because my very experience with these drunks made me become interested in them. And the very thing that they shared with me and nursed me into had kindled a great love for the drunks. The segment of the human race that I disliked the most had become the dearest to me, and they taught me about love. I thought I knew a lot about love. When I was an expert on all other matters, I was a super expert on love. And I got mixed up with a bunch of drunks and found that I knew nothing of love. A love without expectancy. A love without expectancy. This is the most fabulous thing on the face of the earth. The love of one drunk for another. I think it comes closer to comparing with the love of God for his kids. Of any example we have on the face of the earth today, the love of one drunk for another. You see, this is the wonder of a meeting like this we're sitting in right now. We don't expect anything out of anybody. We don't even expect each other to stay sober. You know, we don't expect people to stay sober. That's why we're so tickled when we see each other. We say there's no walls, it's still sober. And it just tickles us to death. A love without expectancy. Now, let's look again at this individual relationship with the Almighty. The thing that has made possible the miracle of AA. Which to me, now I better say this too early, because I keep talking of the miracle, and yet to me it's just a way to say something about something. Because I have come to believe that this way of life, the way of life that I have now, is the only natural, the only normal life there is. The far country experience was not natural and not normal. It is normal for us to be separated from in consciousness. But this way of life is natural and normal. And we use the word miracle simply because it don't so often happen in the world around us. But to me, it's just as natural as can be. And so, let's think a minute. People say to me, but if there were a loving God, and he's personal to the individual, how come he let you lay in the gutter for 10 years? How do you explain this? To me, it's just as simple as falling off of love. God has always known that you and I were his kids. But you and I have to find it out. You see, we didn't know it out here. We might have intellectually believed it. We might have believed in God. But we were consciously separated. Now, God has always known that we were his kids. And so far as he is concerned, there's nothing wrong with us. And he loves us enough to allow us to make our own mistakes, that we might the sooner run out of our own resources and come back home.
You see it?
It's like the prodigal son. He said, give me my inheritance. And the old man gave it to him. You know, he didn't argue with the guy. He just gave it to him. And he went off by himself to run his own life. You know? Consciously separated from. He had some ideas. He was going to cut a big swath for himself. God didn't tell him not to. He let him do it. And the guy ran out of his own resources. And had to spend a little time in the pig pen with the pigs. If this isn't an alcoholic story, I never heard one. You know, the more so because this was a Jew telling the story, you know, and they don't like pigs. They can't abide a pig, you see. And here the monkey is in the pig pen with him. And he's hungry and he tries to eat the swill that the pigs were eating. I know about that pig pen. Okay, we run out of our own resources and we come back home. And where we have always been in reality and have only been separated from it in experience. I am sure of this because, you see, the carpenter told us. He says, who by taking thought can add one cubit to his stature? We can't change the reality of our own being. We can only change our experience in reality. And so this great love of God, which allows us to make our own mistakes, that we might the sooner run out of our own resources and come back home. And the same thing that we have here amongst us. It is not my intent in these few meetings that we have to change anybody's mind or to change anybody's religion or to save anybody's soul. If your soul was lost, trying to get them. According to the rules as I knew them. Not leaving people out of things, but working for things. And doing as good a job as I knew how. It was a getting emphasis all the way through. Because, you see, I'd been born in a family that was too poor to paint and too proud to whitewash. We didn't have penny one. I never saw a quarter until I was big enough to make one. And these things were so important. And I worked so hard to get them. And they ended up at 43 with nothing. Nothing whatsoever, not even health or sanity. And I started living to rub out a record. Now you can't think of yourself and rub out. You simply can't do it. You simply have to do things for people if you're going to rub out. And so I started trying to rub out by doing things for people because I wanted to. Because, you see, my life was over. And I had about 3.5 or 4 years of complete non-expectancy. I asked nothing from no man or from God or from any place else. Nothing. I didn't think I was even entitled to consideration from anybody, including God. And I just went about my business, trying to rub out and trying to practice these principles in all of my affairs, one day at a time. And it's the greatest period of miracles through which I ever lived. Totally unexpected. And every little piece of the jigsaw puzzle fell into place. My own family was put back together. I didn't do it. I never spent 5 seconds trying to convince that family that I was on a new path or that they should come back to me. Not 5 seconds. I never asked a thing of them. Not even consideration. The family was put back together. My job was put back together. I hadn't any more thought that I would ever be in that place than I had flying the moon. I had to go back down there because I had to get even with the man. I had to do the thing he'd paid me for the year before. And he came in to throw me through that window. And he was going to do it, and he could have very easy because I was not in robust health. And I happened to be on the telephone when he walked into the door. Stormed in. He didn't walk in. But then he took the door off. And I'm on the phone, and the phone belongs to him, so he don't want to throw it through the window. He's a frugal man. And so I hung up the phone, and meantime, he'd gotten my drafting board out of the way and had a clear shot at the window. I hung up the phone, and he starts asking me. And I said, Vic, leave me alone. I don't work for you anymore. I'm down here to clean up this desk. I'm here to do the things you paid me for last year that I didn't do. And just as quick as I get even with you, I'll get the hell out of here on my own power. And you'll never owe me a penny as long as you live. But for God's sake, leave me alone. I've got to get even with you. And the old boy stopped in his tracks. And he says, Charlie, what's happened to you? And I says, I don't know. But if you're interested, sit down and I'll tell you what to do. And he sat down there by my desk and he got up sometime later and he was crying like a baby. He stuck out his hand and he says, Charlie, if you're going to live like that, I want to live with you. Now, this was completely and totally unexpected by me. And we had a tremendous experience between that time and the time he retired some 6 years ago. This period, this first little period of total non-expected, I got a new body out of it and I went to a doctor. All the little jigsaw pieces fell into a pattern. Now, what am I talking about? I'm talking about the sufficiency, the all-sufficiency of this thing. The all-inclusiveness. It includes everything that you and I include. And it excludes what we exclude. The all-sufficiency of it. And, of course, the action pattern and the non-expectancy that makes it possible. Now, I haven't been going any place for 17 years. I haven't been searching for 17 years. I searched for 35 years before I got here. But I haven't searched for anything. I haven't attempted to get anything whatsoever in 17 years. I've attempted to add because I wanted to. And infinitely more good has come into my life in this 17-year period than in the entire previous 43. And it's just come out of the same horn, the whole business. health, substance, peace, joy, happiness, fulfillment. It's all come right out of the same book. And now this will be our attempt from now on to relate an action pattern into this concept of life. And to see how it's not up to God, but up to you and to me. To relate ourselves and to be able to read the experience and its lesson. Experience and its lesson. Experience and its lesson. And to walk in peace on this infinite journey of life. God bless you all. And I stopped by a friend's place. This was old man Pierman. He was an old Texas banker. I used to ride horseback with him a lot, and we used to hunt a lot with the hounds. We had a pack of hounds up in Oxnard. And we'd chase coyotes with them out here. It's just like the old southern fox hunt deal, but there was coyotes. And I went back by his house, and his wife said he was gone. Said he had gone down into Orange County someplace. They were having a 3-day hunt. And the only thing she could remember about it was there was something about Linda, old Linda, Linda something. And she thought it was in the Carbon Canyon area. And to make a long story short, I left home about 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock that night. Gouged the gills. And came straight to these hunters. They were up on the other side of this valley. And I came right straight to them. I didn't know where Carbon Canyon was, or I didn't know anything about old Linda, or Yorba Linda, or anything else. But I never missed a foot. I came right into the camp. Spent 3 days in Carbon Canyon. And got home and still didn't know where it was. And I never saw anything. We were standing here looking at this wonderful view. Beautiful country. I never saw it. This morning I can see it. It's quite big. I was up recently to Grass Valley. And one of the drunks up there took me out, showing me the country. Over to Nevada City and around. And that's real beautiful country up in there. And we were passing a lot of churches. Now, again, I have nothing against churches. Don't get me wrong. But here we were out in this wonderful country in the beautiful, beautiful, beautiful scenery. And here we're going by these churches, see? And I finally said to Harry, I says, Harry, isn't it funny that we think that we have to get into a building someplace with walls and a roof in order to worship God? And look at this cathedral we got all around this year. He made this one. Why do we think we got to get into some cramped quarters with a roof over us to worship God? And so we've got a pretty good spot here for our endeavors, I think. There are several amongst us who are not long in this way of life.